Welcome aboard. This is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. We're flying again without our fearless pilot for one more day. Justin Kaufman from
The Download
is here with us. Glad you're here.
As I've now rearranged everything on the desk, I have spent the last 2 hours under the desk rewiring things. When he comes back tomorrow,
he'll find you. And it won't be pretty.
It's going to be hilarious.
Maybe add some booby traps into the studio for him.
Make his soundboard not work kind of thing, you know, just like complicate things and everything, you know, just do the whole
We don't need him getting any crazier.
Yeah, just mess it up a little. Yeah, we don't.
I think it'll be fun.
But it would be fun to see for a few minutes, and then we can
just for a few minutes
back where it belongs
for the first 2 hours of the show tomorrow.
Rose back tomorrow, as we said. But we've got a lot coming up today on this shortened broadcast. We're going to talk
amazing show lined up.
Yes, I mean we're trying to fit it all in today. That's one of those days. The great story, I think, a lot of parents and anybody who's ever played football or sports would be interested in is the legislation introduced in Illinois to ban children under 12, from tackle football.
Yeah, this is amazing. This would be this bill introduced would make Illinois the first state to do so. And, you know, obviously this is something that's been talked about. Representative Senti has been behind this, but also in studio, we'll be talking with Trek Duerson as well.
Dave Duerson's son.
Yeah.
Who said after his father's death and donating his brain to science, figuring out that there were some complications of a long life in football and that this was his next step, that this is something is really important to that family to get done.
When you hear a bunch of NFL stars and NFL coaches come out and say, I'm never going to let my kids play football, it makes you wonder. And this will be a first start to what might be legislated rules and regulations when it comes to human beings playing the sport at a young age.
Change the whole sport, potentially. Yeah, for sure. Mike Monaco will be here, the legal expert, legal analyst for the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, and he is going to talk about some of the legal pitfalls for the president, as he says he's very happy to talk to the special counsel. I'd like to. I'm looking forward to it. I want to do it under oath.
And then you hear his lawyers. What?
And Mike will explain what all that means and what he might advise the president to do and how this all shakes out. How the president, is he treated differently? Because he is the president. So what kinds of special measures are taken when you deal with someone like this coming forward?
Also coming up later, documentary filmmaker Steve James. You know him very well from the man behind Hoop Dreams, the great documentary here in Chicago.
Many said that deserved an Oscar.
And
that
he has a long history of being
robbed
snubbed.
And robbed.
He has been robbed for Interrupters, for Life Itself, the Roger Ebert film, the Hoop Dreams, as we just mentioned.
Uh-huh.
Well, his latest film, Abacus, was just nominated for an Oscar, his first Oscar nomination. Steve James will join us a little bit later in the show. From Park City, he's having a tremendous, tremendous Sundance.
Yeah.
His newest project has been picked up by Stars. He's the belle of the ball, if you will, right now with his new project that he's working on.
Well, he deserves the recognition.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so we'll talk to him.
So that's coming up.
But we also want to weigh in on this whole Tribune Tower. Some plans were revealed by the Tribune today. It set social media afire. People are talking about what are they going to do to the Trib and the property around it. And we want to talk to the reporter who broke that story, Bill Ruth Hart from the Chicago Tribune is here. Bill, thanks for being in studio with us.
Always easy to come downstairs.
Yeah, it's not hard.
For now,
you know,
right?
It's good. We've got decent coffee down here, too, so you can weigh into that. But I think what's interesting here is you revealed some new details. This is a building that's iconic. It has a special place in the hearts of most Chicagoans. People care about it. And what happens next is certainly on the minds of a lot of Chicagoans. What do you know? What can you tell us?
Well, what we've known until yesterday was that, the WGN Radio, the Tribune, we all knew we were going to be leaving this building. Question was going to be, what's going to happen to it? And so what we reported this morning is that Tribune Tower itself, the historic, iconic 36-story structure that's been here since 1925, will be gut renovated into condominiums. Gut renovated.
Have you seen the inside of this building? I mean, there are some areas that seem like they need... No, that aside, I mean, there are some places that you would want to be preserved. The lobby's protected, for instance.
So we can get into some of those details. But definitely, there's already work going on in the upper stories where they're taking everything out but load-bearing walls, basically. And that work's been going on. So Tribune Tower itself would be 165 condos. The lower two stories of the building would have retail wrapped around it. I'm envisioning probably restaurants and shops on Michigan Avenue. And then there would be 365 parking spaces as part of the renovation of Tribune Tower that would be below grade of Upper Michigan Avenue, basically built on top of the surface lot that's behind Tribune Tower now. In addition, the even bigger news is, you know, some of the value that is in the property here, why someone paid $240 million to purchase it,
yeah,
is there's the opportunity to build on that parking lot. And there's a lot of zoning that's not been utilized on the site. The surprise, though, is that they're talking about an extremely tall building, a 1,388-foot skyscraper, which could be the second tallest building in Chicago, contemplating 220 hotel rooms, 158 condos, 500 parking spaces built within the building, similar to Trump Tower on stories 2 through 8.
So right now we have the Willis, the Trump, and then this Hancock would either be that big, as big as the Trump, or bigger.
Correct. This one, the plans right now as they stand are 1,388 feet. Trump Tower is 1,389 feet. My guess is if they build a building that tall, they'll probably find some way to be slightly taller than, right, Trump Tower. Some of these things are in flux. Even when Trump Tower was finished, they actually remeasured it and added like 20 feet a few years later.
I can see him coming to town and building an extra foot after this one's
built.
Yeah, that's
how they do it. They put the spire on it.
Is there a spire on it? Do you count the antenna? These are all
issues that really, yeah,
correct,
don't matter too much, but sure.
Well, Bill, I have a ton. I know we want to break quick to start the traffic at Violetta's traffic update, but when we come back, I definitely want to talk more about how they're going to be able to do this, because as I know this building to be a landmark building, there's a lot of things, mm-hmm, on the outside that are historic. There's a lot of things on the inside, the lobby, of course, right, we'll have that conversation about how do you build new and preserve the old at the same time.
The Tribune Tower and the land around it, we're getting more details about its future and the redevelopment plans. We have with us here Bill Ruthart from Chicago Tribune. Normally covers City Hall, but you got some details on this, and you did talk to the alderman about it. So nothing's quite set in stone yet, but you're just learning some new details.
Yeah, I think this is very much an evolving plan. There are a lot of politics involved. Both the alderman and Mayor Rahm Emanuel's administration ultimately have to sign off on this kind of a thing. So there's been a lot of discussions and plans being shuttled back and forth behind the scenes. Riley acknowledged to us that he's seen 6 or 7 different renderings of this skyscraper. We haven't seen any public drawings of it yet, and he said they're still working on it. So, yeah, he's going to have a big say. He's pushing hard for preservation of certain aspects of the building. He wants the number of parking spaces that have been talked about reduced. He's always a big advocate to incorporate open space into projects. So these are all things he's going to be talking about. But neither he nor the Emanuel administration really have any issues with the height of the building. They don't have a problem with another Trump Tower-sized building right on Michigan Avenue. They think the area can withstand that kind of density, particularly with all the mass transit around. The lower Michigan and Illinois streets can have parking down there.
But a lot of condos, it sounds, according to the details you got, both in this tower here, the Tribune,
right,
Tower, and also the new skyscraper that'll be built behind us. Is
correct?
That right?
I mean, you know, 165 condos in Tribune Tower, 158 in the new skyscraper, and then 220 hotel rooms. So when actually you think about the height of a building like that, mm-hmm, 158 condos really isn't that many.
Yeah.
So it sounds like one of two things. They'll either be pretty good size condos,
sure,
or if we're talking about a very tall but very narrow, mm-hmm, structure, which is kind of the trend in architecture and real estate, particularly in New York City right now.
After your article came out, Chance the Rapper weighed in on social media. It's already been retweeted 7,000 times. He'd like a condo, he's saying, in the Tribune Tower.
He can
tower.
Have my office.
Would you get a cut of that for a commission for kind of like getting him involved in the project, do you think, though?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No?
But
next
time, if Chance just wants to retweet the actual story, we'll take the 7,000
clicks. Yeah, how about it?
You know, Bill, it is a landmark building, and we always talk about there's not a lot you can do structurally to change that. And there's a lot of tourism that comes into the building lobby, and in the sense that there's tours nonstop. I mean, is that going to be preserved, the way that this building looks and feels, and the way that it interacts with its history here in Chicago, or is that something that's really at the whim of the developers that are coming in for this building?
I think some of it's going to be restricted, some of it's an open question. So the Tribune Tower itself, the actual skyscraper, is landmarked. Any changes have to be approved by the Landmark Commission, City Hall. The additions of the WGN radio building and WGN TV building, part of which the Chicago newsroom has been in for many years, those are kind of the additions to the north if you're looking at Tribune Tower facing east. So the Tribune Tower itself is landmarked. The lobby is landmarked. Riley, the question is whether the lobby will be open to the public, all these architectural tours, all these tourists that come in every day. Riley told me he's going to insist on that be remaining open to the public for certain hours. The mayor's administration also agrees with that. There's some other, all the artifacts in the facade of the building that Tribune correspondents brought back from all over the world. I'm told that Riley and the Emanuel administration also are going to insist that those remain in the facade of the building. Riley said some could be relocated to other parts of the building.
Okay.
Part of the discussion is opening up larger windows in the additions, which is where some of those artifacts are.
What about the tributes to free speech that are etched into the limestone?
Yeah, all of that stays. All that's landmarked and protected.
All of that.
There's a couple other features that are open questions. One is Colonel McCormick's office on the, I think it's the 23rd floor. 24th floor. Yeah, McCormick is the legendary publisher of the Tribune who built this iconic building. So Riley wants that office preserved. The developers don't want it open to the public for security reasons. You're going to have residents in this building. So they're contemplating delicately removing the office somehow, perhaps shipping it off to the Chicago History Museum or Cantini, which is McCormick's estate out in West Suburban Wheaton, which is a museum. And then one of the other final issues is the Tribune editorial boardroom on the fourth floor, which has hosted numerous presidents, mayors, governors. It's also an iconic room, and Riley said that the preserving that's also going to be part of the negotiations with the developer.
We understand the adage, make no small plans in Chicago, but we have been burned recently. The Spire comes to mind. Other big skyscrapers come to mind. Projects that are announced with big fanfare, they're put on the front pages of the newspaper, and then they fizzle. Is this in place? I mean, is this a done deal that there's going to be a skyscraper that'll be bigger than Trump Tower behind the Trib Tower?
I would say nothing's done until you see the hole in the ground, but I can't even say that because the Chicago Spire hole is still in the ground.
Great point.
So it's not done until it's done. I think we had during the recession, we had a building on Wacker that was half built for a long time. So no, nothing's guaranteed. You've got the Vista Tower going up right across the river, which is also will be one of the top tallest buildings in the city. What's interesting though is the developer is going to do the rehab of Tribune Tower first, which could take about 3 years. So they'll rehab the existing building, put parking in for that. Then they'll probably come up and see what the real estate market looks like. You talk to real estate experts, some are saying this real estate cycle, which is going bonkers in Chicago right now, 60-some cranes up across the city, has to come to an end at some point. So it could be they even have the next real estate cycle in mind for the skyscraper itself. But yeah, nothing's guaranteed. Golub, the developer, is you know, City Hall sources say they're you know, well-known for doing responsible projects. They don't take big risks. They usually have good capital. So I'm not an expert in that field, but that's the word on the street with them. So
keep us posted, Bill, on the details. Bill Ruthart from Chicago Tribune, City Hall reporter. Thanks for us coming down the elevator and talking to us.
Always good to be here. Thanks.
Judy's News coming up in 2 minutes, and then we're going to talk to Treg Duerson, Dave Duerson's son, about this new legislation to make tackle football illegal or wrong for schools to allow children to play. This is The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman sitting in. You know him. You love him from The Download. Here's the question. Should kids under 12 be allowed to play tackle football? Illinois would become the first state to not allow it if some new legislation passes through. Here with us, the woman who is introducing this legislation, State Rep Carol Senti, and Treg Duerson, for whom this is a very personal issue, something close to his heart, the son of the late, great Dave Duerson, former Bear. And we want to go into that story and what drives you to try to push for protections for children. But let's start with you, Representative Senti. How is this going so far? Are you feeling as if people are on your side with this one?
It's very early to say. We just literally filed the bill this morning. And so the first that you get in your inbox are a handful of the people who are usually most against it. So maybe not some pleasant ones yet.
Why did you get on board? Let's start there then. Why did you say, hey, I'm gonna introduce this into legislation? I think it's a good idea.
Back in 6 years ago, I had a constituent, Dr. Larry Robbins. He has a headache clinic. And he said, Carol, you need to pay attention to this, and I'm asking you to run a bill. And so back then it was to limit tackle during practice, and then that didn't pass, but eventually we did pass to get a concussion certification for high school coaches of all sports, and that did pass. So he kind of just kept feeding me the information and until I couldn't stop. And you look at the data and you say, you've convinced me, and I've been a believer ever since.
Well, let me just ask, what is the bill asked to do? I mean, are we talking about just an outright ban of anyone playing tackle football before the age of 12 or after the age of
12? Is it schools or is it all programs?
It's any organized youth sport organization. We're talking about an all-out ban until you're 12. You can play flag, you can play touch, you can play another sport, but we don't want young brains tackling before age 12.
Let's talk to you, Treg. Your father, Dave Durison, on his untimely tragic death at the age of 50, he left a note saying he wanted his brain donated to science for this very reason. And what they found, did it shock you and your family that there was the concussive history there and that there were issues with his brain?
No, it didn't shock or surprise us, because in the note, it was a detailed note. He not only said, please donate my brain to the NFL Brain Bank, he also listed out some of his symptoms and experiences that he was going through. He talked about his blurred vision, his trouble with spelling, memory loss, as well as a pain that he was feeling in the back of his brain that he thought that something was there.
He was living with it for years, and you knew about it.
Well, my father was a very prideful man. I think when you're talking about NFL players, especially the ones at of his caliber, they tend to hide their weakness until it's too late.
Yeah. For both of you, it's interesting because at the NFL level, when we talk about concussions, you as a fan, you understand that the reason there needs to be protocol is because there's money on the line. These are star players, and they want to play, and they don't really. You get the idea that they don't really care necessarily about the players. That's been the argument over time, and then you can understand at the high school level that there is this idea of building a career. But it almost feels like it's. I think society is ready for the sea change to say under 12 that all of that stuff's out the window. It's not about money. It's not about ambition or career. At a certain point, if this is endangering children who are playing under the age of 12, then yeah, it should be something that just isn't done.
Do they still get hit hard at 6 and 7 and 8 years old?
They do. And I mean, it's really the G-forces are still similar to what they're doing in college, particularly because the helmet is a weapon. It's not used for protection. What I'd say on the point of the NFL, it's interesting that they've got a lot of money, they got protocols in place, they have cameras, they have neurologists, they have the best coaches in the world, and they still can't be right on this issue to a high degree. And how can we expect youth leagues who don't have money, who don't have doctors on the field, who don't have neurologists, and don't have trained and elite coaches there to get this right? And it's time for us to, as a society, to take a lead on this issue. We can't wait for the NFL to do it for us.
And isn't the argument also that once you've played youth football, potentially for years and years and years, and you continue a high school career or perhaps a college career, and then even perhaps beyond that to the NFL, you've been hit in the head so many times, I would imagine, that you wonder how over that period of time, we just don't know. There isn't enough research, is there, to understand? Or what would you say to that, Trent?
Well, that's precisely why this bill is being introduced now. The Concussion Legacy Foundation, a group out of Boston who actually accepted my father's brain donation, has done a lot of research on CTE and the brains, and they recently came up with a study earlier this week that says exposure to repetitive hits over time is the actual cause to CTE. It's not necessarily how many concussions you have. Because previously people were like, well, how many concussions do you have? Do you have CTE? Now it's, well, how many years and how many hits have you sustained over those years?
So that was
small
part of
hits
the impetus
too.
Exactly. To protect kids.
Exactly. It's similar to lung cancer. If you smoke for a decade, the likelihood of you having lung cancer increases.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
And the recent research is really that the subconcussive hits over time are more detrimental than the concussions.
This is a tough situation to legislate. Because you're going in and you're essentially taking away the rights of youth organizations and sports to play a game that they've been playing for decades and decades. Is there pushback? Is there a lobby or a concern that politically you wouldn't be able to get this through the state house?
Or parents also, I would think they might say it's their territory.
Well, I've already gotten some of those comments, and I think that is a natural tendency anytime you look at something like why does the government need to step in again? And I think when it's appropriate is when there isn't any other group and the health, safety, concerns are large enough. And I'd say this issue meets both of those criteria. So, for example, in the in soccer, the U.S. Soccer Federation implemented guidelines.
Right.
No headers for kids under 13.
And hockey is another bigger, right?
The U.S. Hockey Association, no body checking. Did I get that?
Yeah.
Right. That one's 13. Sorry. The soccer is 11 headers. But we don't have an organization that's doing that. And from the ages for football. And so from the ages from 10 to 12, that is a very important age for children's brain development. And so the number of times that they're going to be knocked about in the head and even receiving a force, that would be significant to someone coming up to your kid and punching him in the head.
Yeah, and Greg, it's no different than you would think of Little League saying you can't throw a curveball until you're a certain age because the arms aren't developed. So it does follow logic in which youth sports is using right now.
Other major sports have age modifications. Mm-hmm. I mean, in baseball, you're not taking live pitches into a certain age. When you're a pitcher, as you just said, you know, there's pitch counts involved as well. Sorry, just to go back on a previous point that you made, you know, we're not advocating to get rid of football. That's not what we're doing here. We're just saying take away the tackling.
Yeah.
And football is not about tackling. Sure, tackling is part of football, but what football is really about, it's about a group of 30-plus individuals coming together, achieving a common goal to win the game and overcome a lot of obstacles, and thinking of the right plan and strategy and executing that plan and strategy to win the game. And those lessons can be taught to children without tackling.
When Bob Costas made the comment about CTE destroying the NFL, do you think that's something your father would have applauded, the late, great Dave Duerson? Would he be happy that people are standing up in such a prominent way to draw attention to this? Or is that the wrong thing to say because he loved football so much? He wants it to thrive and just protect the athletes more. How do you think he'd feel?
I think he'd definitely be behind CTE and individuals standing up. Saying that they have issues and science proving that and evolving and proving the fact that there are a lot of things to be concerned about.
But if the NFL has evolved so much, can it really do more, I guess is what he's saying, and they feel as if they've got the protections in place now to do as much as they can to protect that maybe weren't involved when he was playing the sport. Are they doing a pretty good job now, and is there a chance that too much attention at that level is bad for the sport?
I think you hit it right on the head right there, where too much attention to the NFL is bad for the sport because we're emphasizing so much concussion protocol for the Cam Newtons of the world, but we're not talking about the millions of children below 12 that are playing football who most of them will not attain the fortune of fame of pro football players.
Right.
And that's the most important piece of this. You know, the NFL has their own protocols and procedures to deal with. And to me, let's let them have their pro game, and they can do whatever they want with it. But for youth football, we as a society have to step in, and we can't look at them to be the leader.
This is a passion project for you and your family, I know. Is it because your father, you believe that your father's troubles started very early and that that was part of the reason that things happened for him the way they did, developing CTE?
Well, I mean, the research today is part of the puzzle is that, you know, my father started playing football around the age of 11 or 12 and did so through high school and college and played 11 years in the NFL. I mean, that's a lot of exposure to hitting. Which obviously led to his demise. When we donated my father's brain, we did so to get clarity and to get answers to a lot of personal questions that we dealt with from some strange behavior that we've seen in his life, from his forgetfulness and depression and anger and all of those things, which all contributed to why we would even donate his brain. But why I'm so passionate about it and why my family is so passionate about it is that when he did take his own life, he made the decision to donate his brain simultaneously. And that, to me, shows that this is someone who is looking out for other people and other interests in the future of, you know, football and
the
sport
that he loves.
And that to me is just, you know, I'm here today to keep honoring that legacy and his last wishes.
All right, we're talking about the Dave Duerson Act. It is being introduced in Illinois here. It would be the first state that would ban tackle football for children under 12. Our guests are State Rep Carol Senti, who's introducing legislation, and Trey Duerson, the son of Dave Duerson, named for this bill. And we had a couple of texts here that are really, thank you for them.
There's some really interesting stuff, because 630 says, I've played for 6 years. Every practice I left with a headache. 20 years later, I still feel problems from it. I feel some parents may make the wrong decisions. I'm glad someone's stepping up for the voiceless.
708, I agree. Concussions are an issue. However, as a coach, I believe the problem lies in the hands of many of the coaches that have and continue to teach the use of the head and helmet as a blocking, tackling tool. I bench my kids when I see that happening.
If I can follow up just on that, Craig, I mean, a lot of what has been talked about is education, awareness. Even with the fans of the game of football, there's more awareness that it's not to get too excited about a helmet-to-helmet hit or a big explosive collision on the field. When we see at the NFL level, there's so much made about the blue tent and concussion protocol, and they're really getting. But when you go down to college, there's some what do you call it? There's other rules that are now getting kids ejected from games. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the high school level and what we're seeing in youth sports, is there at all a push towards making sure that concussions are top level when it comes to the safety of these kids?
I think so. I think we've made tremendous strides here in Illinois, especially. And there was a bill that Senator Kwame Raoul passed about a return-to-play bill that if you have a concussion on the field, you have to go see a medical doctor before coming back. I mean, that's major steps on a legislative side. I'd also say just on a cultural side, there's been a tremendous trend of people paying attention to concussions and knowing that there is severe impact to it.
Well, you see parents pulling their kids out of football in some cases at a young age because they don't want that exposure or they're fearful of it, and perhaps this would prevent that as well, I suppose.
The bill?
Yeah.
I think so. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in Highland Park, Illinois. My brother played in Highland Park youth sports. Highland Park does not offer football anymore, and Highland Park stopped offering football because people stopped sending their children to play. You know, but I think if we can provide an opportunity for young children to learn the basic techniques and fundamentals of football. Mm-hmm. And as that coach pointed out, there's a lot of poor coaching or poor proper technique for people tackling. And I have to give the NFL credit for the heads up program that they're leading, that if you're going to tackle somebody, you should keep your head up. So there's a lot of safety things that we could put in place.
Real quick, Representative Senti, what's the next level? What's next for this bill? I mean, are we going to see this introduced? And how do you see this moving forward in the state of Illinois?
Well, the step one was getting a bill number this morning and letting people know that it's out there and they can read the language. It will eventually be assigned to a committee. Moving forward, it is to answer questions of my peers, talk to constituents and people on both sides of this issue and make them aware of the real data and what we're trying to do here.
Thank you so much for sharing the information with us. We appreciate it. It's the Dave Duerson Act. Trey Duerson and State Rep Carol Senti, thank you so much for your time. Can people reach either one of you if they want to find out more information, get involved with the effort to help?
Absolutely.
They can
call my office or email me at repsenti@gmail.com.
And Trey, are you part of any organization where people could reach you, or is it more of a social media kind of reach?
It's more of a social media kind of reach.
Well, that's good enough.
I was like, should I give out my personal cell phone?
No. I wouldn't do that. But we appreciate that. We appreciate that offer. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. We've got Judy's
Thanks
News
for
coming
us.
Up. This is the Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman filling in for Ro today. He's back tomorrow. And
yes.
We want to check in with Tom Skilling. And Tom, we want to get to the weather with you. A little talk about that. And then we have a special guest, if you don't mind. We're going to rope him into the conversation for something special.
Absolutely. No, I actually, Jeff just, your
he
producer.
Just let you know?
He just gave me a heads up, and it sounds cool.
Yes.
So.
He's on top of things, that Jeff Carlin.
He is indeed.
So,
I'll tell you that.
I heard you, Sergio, heard you just a few minutes ago. We feel nice and warm today, but don't really get used to it.
Well, tomorrow will be even better. It could start kind of cloudy, but turn partly sunny. Tomorrow we'll get up to the 50s.
Ooh,
and then Sunday. Saturday, the temps will start dropping, and Sunday will be chilly, and Monday, downright chilly, a pretty moderately cold blast of air with perhaps a little lake effect snow flurry action. But we'll be back to 50 for a day on Wednesday, and then the Arctic air locks in with a little more persistence after that. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about highs still in the low and mid-20s later next week. So that it could be a lot worse.
No. Now, we've been talking, Tom, this week, and I'm learning a lot from you this week, but as Roe is out, we'll be back tomorrow. But, you know, this idea of 50-degree weather means when the Arctic air comes in, there's turbulence, there's at least prospect for trouble. Do you see that on the horizon?
You know something, Jeff? You're absolutely right, or Justin, I'm sorry. And you're absolutely right. This is the kind of temperature contrast that sets up storms. Right now, we don't see one. But it's the kind of pattern that we've been mentioning. We've got to watch, and we'll see if anything starts showing up. It just looks like we're going to get cold. It does appear once we get into the cold air that we may bring some clipper systems down, and we could get some snow with that. That would start, you know, the week after next, and maybe late next week. So, but big storm, not yet visible. So,
Tom, there's no way. And there's no way that
we're going to get through this.
What I was going to say is I want to make a transition. There's no way that you possibly watch SNL because there is just no way that you have any time left
hours
in
the day.
Right?
I love SNL. Who doesn't?
Lately, it's been pretty good.
And in this era of all the activity out in Washington,
it's nice to be able to laugh at it.
At
the end of the week.
Must-see TV. No question about it.
No, I agree.
Well, this is a good story. Today it was reported in Rob Feeder that they have the new SNL exhibit at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, which is fabulous.
It sounds really cool.
It's
so
good. Tom, go
see
it.
Great reviews. People are raving about it.
It's really fun. It's not just, you know, artifacts. It's telling the story, and it's done from New York producers who are attached to SNL who come in, and they've created something that it's probably the best exhibit going on right now here in Chicago. Anyway.
And it's experiential, and it's interactive, and all that fun stuff.
One of the great things about it is that in glass you will see some of the great costumes from Saturday Night Live lore. So all the history.
Some of the sketches that you just love.
Like Wayne's World's couch is there, but then you've also got all these great costumes, you know, and a lot of Will Ferrell stuff, right? That's a lot, because he was a big thing. So the cheerleader and the other things.
Yeah.
And today, Robert Feeder talking about how Will Ferrell, who's hosting SNL this week, is in need of some of his old costumes, and they are actually on display. This is not, they're not replicas. They're on display.
Well,
so SNL wants them back. Yeah, it's amazing.
You visited and thought, well, this is probably replica.
That was my first thought as I go, you know what? I get it that this is the cheerleader. Maybe it's the one he wore, but they could replicate these however they want. Not the case. In studio with us right now, Justin Kolovsek. Is that right? Got it? Kolovsek, Vice President, Innovation, SNL Project Lead, and Museum of Broadcast Communications guy. Good to see you, Justin. Thanks for coming over.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This really, I mean, the story I just told, this is something that was a surprise to you on an urgent call saying, you got to move for us.
Literally got a call on Saturday morning. Hey, we have a special guest that's going to be on, and we need you to go to the museum and pick up some of his costumes.
That's great.
And I'm like,
what?
Okay, what's going on?
Is this real?
Yeah.
I mean, were you?
Exactly. And so they let me know that it was Will Ferrell, that he was going to be hosting. They would be announcing it that night. And by 4 o'clock, because we had to get the FedEx drop-off, we had to have these things in there. And so I said, what do you need? And he said, we need his cheerleader costume.
Of course.
That's great.
And we also need his Harry Carey costume.
Oh, it's perfect.
Which we have both of, and they are the originals. And so Justin went down there. This is also the day of the Women's March.
Oh, that's easy to get
So just think of where the museum is, right by
right.
Trump Tower,
right
very there, yeah, very exactly. close by.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we also had like 400 to 500 people there that day.
Wow.
And so it was this huge day. And so I've got the gloves on, the artifact gloves and everything, because it's all, you know, everything, you have to follow all the procedures.
You can't get Cheeto dust on the cheerleader outfit.
Right.
Right.
Maybe on the Donald Trump, maybe you could do that, but not
right.
there. So literally, I'll have the gloves on, going to go and get the cheerleading costume.
Uh-huh.
And one of the docents runs up to me and says, there is a cheerleading squad literally here in the next room.
Oh,
they're
no.
here to take photos with the cheer. And I'm like, okay, well, then we're going to go.
So you had to wait?
Had to wait a little bit.
Okay.
Because there were all these people also around.
Yeah,
and
you
like,
can
what's
just walk
going
in the middle
on?
And take the.
You know, hey, everyone, we're doing this even though we're not supposed to announce it yet. that Will Ferrell's going to be on. So,
and now we'll kind of know what he's going to be doing on the show as well, because he's going to do the cheerleading thing, presumably.
Well, here's how they'd used it. Yeah,
So they used both the Harry Carey and the cheerleader costumes. Actually, Leslie Jones did a promo where she was making fun of Will Ferrell and kind of mocking him of his pieces. So it's actually on our Facebook page.
Oh, we'll check it out.
So in other words, are you guys returning the outfits to Saturday Night Live for this weekend show? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, so actually we had to ship them back.
That's great.
And they will ship them back to us.
To you, put back on display. Again.
Exactly.
That's amazing. And the best part, and you told me this, is that when you had to actually take the costumes to the FedEx or wherever you had to, you're walking through the Women's March with a huge unmarked package in your hand, and the police weren't necessarily friendly to that idea.
Yeah, got stopped right in front of Trump Tower, basically, because I was parking right in the garage right there. And sure enough, they're like, what do you have? Uh-huh. And I'm like, you're not going to believe me if I tell you. It's just not going to happen. And sure enough, then, okay, yeah.
You think this will be a regular thing where they're going to be tapping into you guys to say, hey.
You've got our archive.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope so, because
too.
It really is. It's all authentic. It's all the costumes. It's all the different set pieces. Everything from the Jeopardy, Turd Ferguson setup to the Wayne's World couch that was used on the 40th to then our full replica of home base up on the fourth floor.
I love it.
It's really great. And Tom, I've been meaning to ask you before Roe comes back tomorrow, but you, of course, over at WGN TV, you got Pat Tomasulo doing Man of the People.
Right.
Now, has he got a big head over there? When are you going to be all
over
that?
I hear good things about the show.
Yeah.
Didn't you love the promo for that?
Yeah.
They did MOS, Man on the Street promo.
Excellent.
And they said, now, what do you think of Pat? Well, and they just he's okay, and he's a genius.
I know
he really is very funny. I've done some bits with him, and he's written them. And the guy is a riot. So I think this thing's going to be a real success.
Well,
but we haven't done anything yet.
He
was in here before I went on vacation, and our paths never crossed. So maybe he has something in mind.
Yeah. Tom, promise us a field trip to the SNL exhibit, okay?
Oh,
we're all going to go out there.
That would be great, Anna. I you hear nothing but rave
Me
reviews.
Too. Same thing.
And Tommy works down there.
Yeah.
He does a great job. Mm-hmm. He's a fellow you see as the elf on our show, on the morning show.
Yes, that's right.
But he also works on the SNL exhibit down there at the Broadcasting Museum. And he said it's really spectacular.
I know you have to go because you have things to do in the weather department. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks, Anna. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later, guys.
Justin, can you stick around just for a couple more minutes? We want to talk museum, some stuff with you.
Sure, we'd love it.
The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is here from The Download, sitting in for Ro today. We have another Justin Kolubsek from the Museum of Broadcast Communications and the SNL exhibit, Saturday Night Live, which is getting rave reviews, a lot of people talking about it. Is this a museum? I've heard that you don't have to know everything about SNL. You don't have to follow it over generations. That even kids who really don't even have the recall can enjoy this museum.
Yeah, people, they walk in not knowing really what to expect. You learn a lot and you laugh a lot. I think that's what you'd say. It's one of these exhibits where it takes you through that Monday through Saturday process, the same process that Will Ferrell's going through right now, this week, as hosting. And so it starts in Lorne Michaels' office. Tuesday, the writers start writing. Wednesday, the read-through room. I know, Justin, you said that's one of the ones you really loved over there. Thursday, all set design, and so that's all the Wayne's World couch and looking at what Stiegelbauer does. And then Friday, where all the costumes are on display, where we were taking costumes down to get them off to
Studio
H.
As a comedy geek myself,
I know.
What I found interesting is that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to go to this saying, "Oh, I know SNL. I've read the books. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of biographies. People who've done so much to tell the story of how SNL works." And I'm one of those people. And to go into that experience at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, I learned stuff that I did not know other places. I mean, even the beginning, there's a documentary that they do right at the beginning about the beginnings of Saturday Night Live in 1975 and what was happening in New York City, and what they were actually broadcasting in those first couple episodes was satire and parodies and things that were happening with the relationship between Gerald Ford and the mayor of New York City, and that's why you have Gerald Ford falling down. It was very interesting stuff that I did not know about the history of not just SNL, but our country.
And that we have Johnny Carson really to thank for SNL. He didn't want reruns of his show on Saturday nights, and so Dick Ebersol was told to find
something.
Yeah.
Thank God he did. You think about the decades. And you have things on display here that really have never been on display before. I heard John Belushi's Killer Bees outfit is there. All the things that sort of bring back laughs from over the years.
Absolutely.
It's bring them back again.
Bill Murray's lounge singer jacket. There's... we even have one of Alec Baldwin's Trump outfits from last season. We have a pair of Gilda Radner's shoes, one of the very few artifacts that SNL actually had of Gilda's.
Yeah.
And those are actually for the first time being displayed.
Is this what is this doing for the Museum of Broadcast Communications? You've done a lot about the history of media, and it's been a great institution here in Chicago, but having this kind of exhibit that has such a high profile and people know about it and keep coming because of word of mouth, what's it doing for the bottom line of the Museum of Broadcast?
Sure. I mean, it really is putting a whole new vibe around the museum. People are not only coming in for SNL, but then we invite people to go down to our permanent collection as well, so they can hear all about Ray Rayner and Cuddly Dudley and Bozo and the Meet the Press set and the Kennedy Nixon camera and all of that as well. So it's really also bringing a lot of people in. Like, I had no idea, one, that this place even existed. Two, I had no idea all these other artifacts that you guys have. And the museum has over 85,000 hours of television and radio also on, you know, in our archive. Uh-huh. So there's so much to do. There's from an educational perspective, but again, also from the SNL perspective. Let's have fun. Let's laugh.
And it's tucked over in kind of a strange place, because you might walk by it without even knowing it's there. But describe it to us, and then
so it's State and Kinsey.
Yeah, so centrally located,
right next to House of Blues. So that's what I always say to people. If people are, I don't know where that is. Mm-hmm. It's literally there. We're between House of Blues and Harry Carey's. So
now you can't miss it, because I drive by there every day, and there is a huge mural banner of Stefan and some of the other characters from SNL just right smack right at the corner of State and Kinsey. It's really great.
It's awesome. Well, thank you, Justin, for coming by to talk and
pleasure.
Share those great stories. And when you get more, tell us about them, please.
I definitely will.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Judy's News coming up in 2 minutes, and then Mike Monaco talks about the president talking to the special counsel.
There's been no collusion whatsoever. There's no obstruction whatsoever. And I'm looking forward to it. I do worry when I look at all of the things that you people don't report about.
President set to meet with Bob Mueller, the special counsel. He says he's looking forward to it, and he'd like to do it under oath. But his attorneys, they're walking that back a little bit. Well, it's not exactly what we meant. This is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman here, and the official legal analyst for the Rokan Show is Mike Monaco.
Well,
Mike.
Well, thank you very much. How are you, Anna?
I'm okay.
Yeah, so...
Is this a good idea?
So yesterday,
go ahead.
The president, off the cuff, when asked, said, oh, he'd be happy to testify under oath to Mr. Mueller. And then his lawyer said he was speaking hurriedly.
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 That sounds like a great lawyer term. No, well, he was speaking hurriedly.
He was speaking hurriedly.
And he only meant to say that he was willing to meet with Mueller. What's the difference? Explain it to us.
Of course, Mueller has options, because if the president refuses to meet with him, he can subpoena the president. And then the president would have to decide whether there would be some sort of executive issue raised, but even before he went to speak to the grand jury, so that would be a huge constitutional issue.
Yeah.
And then after that, of course, the question is: will he testify? Will he take the Fifth? It sounds. I've been involved in many cases representing congressmen and local officials, and they're hesitant to take the Fifth, because the last thing they want is that to become public. There was years ago, a well-known congressman from New York took the Fifth. And sort of denied it when he was running for election, and then because he brought it up and denied it, the U.S. attorney at the time was Rudy Giuliani, made it public that the congressman had taken the Fifth in the grand jury, which was and then he lost the election. But
But what is the difference when you say, okay, you know, I'm willing to talk to him, be interviewed by him?
That means nothing.
Lying to the FBI is still a crime,
yeah,
as we've
for
seen.
Sure. What the president said yesterday really, really legally means nothing. He's not compelled to do anything based upon what he said yesterday. But, of course, if he does now make it difficult on the prosecutor to either call him as a witness or question him, then questions will arise. So when Clinton was questioned by Starr's committee, he was not forced to go to the grand jury, but they talked to him, I think, in the map room of the White House, and they questioned him under oath, and it was televised. And the grand jury watched it.
So it really was like before the grand jury.
It was like before the grand jury. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, everyone's talking about whether or not the president will or will not make statements to the grand jury, answer Mueller's questions, whether he'll do it in writing or whether he'll have to do it in person. It seems to me Mueller, as I say, has options, and he has sort of some cards in his quiver here. So he could force the president to subpoena the president if the president refuses to come and talk to him.
How often do you see it where a client will jump out in front of the media and talk to him, say, I'm open book, I'll talk about it, I'll go under oath and do everything before the lawyers can jump
rare,
in.
Very rare.
Do you call them then and tell them, shut up?
So what's different, though, is these are politicians.
Yes.
So politicians are different. Like, I remember when I think one of the local congressmen, Henry Hyde, was supposed to testify in some, not his case, but some other case.
Well, look at Blagojevich. He went on TV everywhere to say, talk, play all the tapes, and he wanted to get his piece out.
Yes, to his detriment, actually. Yeah.
But there must be some special sort of circumstance when dealing with deference, or when you're dealing with the president of the United States, isn't it? I mean, I've heard negotiations. It's being reported by the Wall Street Journal and others that there might be some Q&A included, that his lawyers would be able to carefully vet questions that that Mueller and his team would submit to the president. Then he would be able to write them.
Right. There was some talk about that. But as I say, Mueller will decide what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so if he plays it tough with the president, which of course may play into the president's cards, because the president is claiming, of course, that it's all unfair. It's baseless, is what his word was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so, the more they find out about what the Russians actually did and what the campaign did to help the Russians, which is what which we know they did something, because two people have pled guilty already to lying about it.
But wouldn't it be obstruction that they would be going after the president in this case? And would there be enough there to really say he would have to step in the way of this investigation?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not so sure. If he knows that Comey was investigating him and his campaign involving the Russians, and he admits that he fires Comey, which he admitted that he fired Comey to slow down or stop the Russian investigation, does that amount to obstruction of justice? I think people could say, sure it does. That's exactly what it is.
Do your public statements count as
absolutely
in an investigation?
Well, not total truths, but clearly it'll be used against him, and he will be asked about that, of course, whenever he's questioned by Mueller.
Mike, another thing the president said is he said, you know, this is totally untrue or unfair, and I'm going to start fighting back.
Yeah, now he says fighting back, and he says fighting back to sort of explain the fact that he and all the other Republicans, it seems, are saying horrible things about the FBI. And now that is unbelievable that they're doing that. That here the Republicans, who for years were the party of conservative, of
law enforcement.
Law enforcement, yeah, right. And here now they're blasting the FBI because the FBI is investigating the president of the United States. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So I think he's saying that. as that's sort of his card, that they're claiming, oh, well, see, if you do that, it shows how unfair you are. If you're tough on the, if you make the president go down to the grand jury and talk to the grand jury in person, they didn't make Clinton do that. That shows you how unfair this special prosecutor is.
Right. Well, the politics play into this no matter what, because it is, you know, a president and a political figure. But one of the things I want to ask you, Mike, though, is you've always told us when you're testifying or giving a deposition, you don't want to talk too much.
Right, I was talking mostly about Roe there. Roe should not talk
Roe's
too much.
Roe's passed that along, that helpful yes. information, because he likes to talk, Roe.
Yes.
And unfortunately,
yes.
in certain scenarios, it's bad for you to talk.
And you mentioned Blagojevich recently. Blagojevich, same thing. Blagojevich could never stop talking. I mean, I represented his chief fundraiser, and it was just horrible what happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's,
but the president is prone to talk.
The president is the same thing. Now, the president has been deposed several times, once on a case here in Chicago, which the president won. He came to Chicago, testified, and the jury found in the president's favor. As you know, it's hard in many cases to get a celebrity and to rule against him. Now, here, the fact that he's a president and has sort of, it seems, upset a lot of people as president and actually has a lot of fans as well. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But he does talk a lot, and because people who work for him say that he thinks he can talk anybody out of anything, but I'm just not so sure that's
I was reading today,
smart move.
He hasn't done well in a lot of depositions. His style doesn't work that well and right. be on that microphone with the committee and people asking him questions. He's much better when he's got the microphone in control of what the narrative is. He finds himself speaking around and getting lost and not doing as well as he's done maybe in rally situations and other places.
No, that's true.
One of the things you find is then with a special counsel or the feds, you don't know what they know. You don't know what others have already given up as they've moved up the food chain to you.
Right. Now, that's what his lawyers are working on now, trying to figure out what Flynn has said, trying to figure out what the other folks who have been indicted have said. And now it looks like Gates, who had worked for Manafort and was also under indictment, he's hired a new lawyer named Green, who in Chicago represented the congressman who was accused of paying hush money to the
Dennis Hastert.
Dennis Hastert. You represent Dennis Hastert here in Chicago. Mm. He's with Sidley and Austin, a big Chicago firm.
Yeah, right.
And so, and now the fact that they hired Green, there was some news yesterday as to whether that means that Gates is going to flip. So we'll see what that means.
You know, we're going to take a break here. Mike, can you just stick around? We want to ask you about Michigan State University.
Sure.
We saw the resignation of the president today under fire for all of the gymnasts that her doctor at her school, who was employed by her school.
Larry Nassar
has obviously done to these children, now been sentenced to this incredible sentence. And who knew what when and who could be potentially in legal jeopardy within this university? But we'll get to that in a moment. This is the Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman of the Download fame is here with us today as Ro's got one more day off, and he's back tomorrow. We have the official legal analyst for the Ro Khan Show, Mike Monaco, with us. So much to ask today, Mike. So glad you're here.
Thank you.
You know, getting into Michigan State University, USA Gymnastics. Obviously,
right.
We saw yesterday the doctor, Larry Nassar, getting 40 to 175 years on top of his sentence he already had for child pornography. The question has, you saw that the president of Michigan State University has resigned.
Right.
What when we start talking about the next shoe to drop, is it criminal? Is it civil? Where does the legal system take us on this terrible, confounding, horrible case?
So you would think the place to look at is what happened at Penn State.
Yeah.
When the coach there was accused and found guilty of abusing children. And there, the president of Penn State went to jail.
That's right. So did the vice president and the athletic director.
Right. They went to jail for really neglecting to do anything. I should say neglecting, deciding not to do anything about the allegations of child sexual abuse that they had that had been made to them. So they were convicted of child endangerment and of refusing to do anything in the face of allegations of child sexual abuse. Just like in Illinois, it's a crime to if you have an obligation to report it. So here, I guess the question is how many people knew about the fact that these young mostly young women were being abused by Dr. Nassar, and did they report it to the people at Michigan State? Now they claim, and they and the effort is, the show the record is that they objected and did complain to the United States Olympic Committee,
right?
And they're all upset about that the U.S. Olympic right. Committee didn't really do anything to about their complaints. Now, if the Michigan State, if as well the young women who were abused by Dr. Nassar at Michigan State did complain to somebody at Michigan State, somebody in within the hierarchy of the university, those people too would
well. What's surprising to me is that there were allegations that surfaced, and you're right. I'm not sure if it was to the committee or to Michigan State that the allegations of abuse were levied against Dr. Nassar, and Michigan State University kept him in practice,
right?
Which is surprising. I mean, in this day and age, most places they take a leave, suspension, what it might be, yeah. But he continued his work.
Well, he apparently was on good paper with the Olympic Committee.
And they were sending him as a must-see doctor. Some of these
exactly.
gymnasts were told, yeah, you have to see this guy.
He'll save your career. If you have a problem,
but
he'll help you.
The Washington Post has a pretty damning article today about how 14 people at MSU knew, were warned about the Nassar abuse, and it goes all the way up the chain. At least one of these abuse claims, they confirm, reached the level of the president. I don't know if that's what caused her to resign today, but if that's true, if that many people within the administration had been warned over these years, would there be civil action?
Yeah. Well,
would they take control of the university? First.
There will be civil suits for sure, but then the question is, will they also face jail time?
That's right.
And it's a bigger burden, obviously, to convict someone of a criminal offense here, but... just like in Penn State, if people knew that these allegations were being made and ignored them, ignored them or worse, hid them, if they did anything to hide them, if they did anything to, you know, to sort of, have a cover up about the whole thing, that would be a huge problem for Michigan State.
People forget at Penn State there are, of course, the criminal cases, but there are also fines were levied, and there were so many settlements that were put out. There are quarters of $1 billion.
Penn State lost a lot of money.
When we start talking about civil lawsuits, and there's 156 victims, both who were of Dr. Nassar, both Michigan State University, USA Gymnastics, is that what we're going to see here? Settlements?
And
the question is, do these go to just what is the stance for Michigan State University or USA Gymnastics? I mean, they just have to settle?
Well,
if they have a good attorney like Mike Monaco.
Yeah, if there was evidence that somebody at the university was told about these allegations of child sexual abuse and they did nothing about them, there will be plenty of successful lawsuits, I'm sure.
And you look at what happened at Penn State and what a downfall that fine university took.
Yeah, it was horrible.
A hit over something like this. I think it's hard for most of us to even believe how this many people could have come forward about one guy, and if it's true what is being reported, that at least 14 members of the university knew about it, that no one did anything.
Yeah, this is a very unusual situation that this doctor, I mean, we assume it's unusual since, now, of course, doctors are heralded. You know, we put doctors on a pedestal. We give doctors the benefit of the doubt in almost every case. Now, very often in Illinois, sometimes you'll see doctors are charged. Just yesterday, I saw some dentist was charged with sexually abusing a patient. And dentists is more difficult, but I remember there was recently a case, or a couple of years ago, where the defendants showed the jury what an average sexual inspection of a woman's body a normal doctor would have to make, and it's invasive, and so that's probably what this doctor was using to help him get through to do this to these poor children,
right?
But it's a good question, but I'm certain that this fellow's gotten so much bad publicity that this Dr. Nassar, that there are going to be plenty of lawsuits, if not criminal convictions.
It might speak to just how manipulative and how good he was at covering up these evil ways that he had.
Right.
These evil methods.
Right. Now, I didn't know. Was he married?
I don't know his background.
It just seems like he was been doing this. This is like he was the... he was on top of the world in terms of the children's gymnastics, and he was the guy to see.
And he was. Thank you, Mike Monaco. We appreciate it. Let's check in with Judy Pylock in 2 minutes with the news here on WGN. This is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is here from The Download today. Ro's back tomorrow, and we're happy you're here.
Yeah, and one more hour, Blackhawks starting early. You know, they're out in Detroit. It's going to start their run right now because it's going to be the road games where they focus and come together.
Absolutely true.
But that's an early start, and so Chris has the... pregame at 6.
Oh, yeah, pregame. Yeah. And speaking of the Blackhawks, listen after 5:40 tonight for your chance to play Blackhawks Pick'em to win a $50 gift certificate to Lou Malnati's.
There you go.
Not bad. All right. It is that special time of day, that time of day when we do the...
On the Rokan Show.
Five.
Let's go.
Four, 3, 2, 1.
Now, it's the top 5 at 5 on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
We will. Checking in at
number 5.
President Trump spoke with reporters last night about a possible face-to-face sit-down with Bob Mueller, the special counsel, and seemed, well, he's ready. Let's go.
I'm looking forward to it, actually.
You want to?
You have a date set?
Here's the start, just so you understand. There's been no collusion whatsoever. There's no obstruction whatsoever. And I'm looking forward to it. I do worry when I look at all of the things that you people don't report about. With what's happening, if you take a look at, you know, the 5 months worth of missing texts. But I would love to do that, and I'd like to do it as soon as possible.
Well, do you have a date set?
I don't know. No, I guess they're talking about 2 or 3 weeks, but I would love to do it. You know, again, it's, I have to say, subject to my lawyers and all of that, but I would love to do it.
I mean, asterisk. I mean, asterisk.
Today, his lawyers are giving interviews saying, well, we're going to make some final decisions about whether how this goes down, if he's going to talk under oath. And he was just speaking hurriedly when he said that. So probably likely not to be. But they say they're fully cooperating, have turned over 20,000 documents to the special counsel. What do you need? We got it. And the president is soon, within weeks, a matter of weeks, we're told, will be speaking with the special counsel in one way or another. We have a bonus clip here, I believe. And the president was asked about his willingness to be interviewed under oath. This is an answer that, much to the surprise of his lawyers.
You mean like Hillary did it under oath? Who said that?
I said that. Oh. Would you do it under oath?
You said it. You did say it. You say a lot. Did Hillary do it under oath?
I have no idea, but I'm not asking.
I think you have an idea. Don't you have an idea?
Do you think
Hillary? Wait. Do you not have an idea? Do you really not have an idea? I'll give you an idea. She didn't do it under oath.
But I would do it under oath.
Listen,
you would.
But I would do it. And you know she didn't do it under oath, right?
She would do it under oath.
If you didn't do it, if you didn't know about Hillary, then you're not much of a reporter.
That's all of the greatest hits of Trump, all in one clip.
He's got his whole game right there on display.
He belittled the reporters. This doesn't know what they're talking about. Said he would do it, but at the same time, throughout asterisks, you know, I'm the cool president, guys. You know me, I'm cool. I'm cool president. I mean, it's these lawyers, these pinhead lawyers, but me, I'm cool president.
Speaking of pinhead lawyers, it seems like his lawyers are saying we're not so sure about the under oath part.
Could you imagine if you were a defense lawyer for Donald Trump and the president, and he just did that kind of stuff. He did that talk. It's very, I mean, we just talked with Mike Monaco. It's very Blagojevich. And you saw how that worked out. At a certain point, when you start to thumb your nose or flip off the justice, the lady justice, as what's happening in the White House right now, that's going to come back and bite him in the butt.
It has to, right? It can, but there's when you're a politician, I think there's that public side of you you want to withhold that's separate from the actual lawsuit, and I think that's what we're seeing on display here, but it doesn't seem likely.
I'm trying not to, a bipartisan approach. Maybe there's no collusion. Right. And there's a good argument to be made for that. And maybe there's no obstruction of justice, especially if he believes that there was no collusion. Mm-hmm. But my gosh, the way that the president talks off the cuff and talks to the media and does all that stuff, it just makes you go, what is OK, look into it.
Right.
He almost opens the door for you to look into it.
kind of has put his foot in his mouth, and that, that will be a problem.
It's very
the comments he's made about Comey will come back.
He did media training with Chicagoans who remember Rod Blagojevich and how much he put his foot in his mouth.
Well, we'll see what happens, because all indications are this is coming close to an end, the Mueller
investigation. I'm the cool president. I'm cool president.
Checking in at...
Number four.
Baseball Writers Association of America made their selections for the list of 2018 Baseball Hall of Fame inductees yesterday, headed to Cooperstown. Chipper Jones, Vladimir Guerrero, Trevor Hoffman, and someone who's still a fan favorite from his time here in Chicago, Jim Thome.
Hello.
Hello. Good. May I speak with Jim Thome, please?
This is him.
Jim, this is Jack O'Connell with the Baseball Writers Association in New York. I'm calling to let you know that the baseball writers have elected you to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Congratulations. Oh.
Thanks, Jack.
I congratulate you for a terrific showing in the election. And
Thank you so much.
It's the beginning of a new life for you.
So. Oh, my gosh. I don't know what to say. This is just an honor, and it's just so special.
Chills, and I'm not even a White Sox
quiver
fan.
Quiver in my voice.
I know.
No, when I saw that clip last night, when they showed it in one of the newscasts last night, and then his wife starts crying, and he has a little tear, and his kids are right there. It is so emotional. It's a tearjerker.
He's an awesome dude, though. Yeah. When the whole tornado hit Washington a few years back, Cochran show, we went out there and did the show there, and he showed up, donated $100,000 of his own money to relief. Huge charity guy. Still a special assistant to Rick Hahn with the White Sox, and just an awesome dude.
Yeah, and you got to say, there is something to be said. You saw what happened with the continuing dismissal of the steroid era guys, Clemens and Sosa.
They don't want to admit it, but it's much harder for players that were jerks to the media, whether anybody wants to admit it.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. They're a jerk to the media. It's a lot harder for you to get in the Hall of Fame.
Because it's the baseball writers, right?
It should not be at all. Right. But yes, Jim Thome, you can't think of a much more perfect Hall of Fame type guy on the field, off all that stuff. So happy for him.
Correct me if I'm wrong on Jim Thome. Did they employ a shift on him? Was that before the shift became baseball?
No, that's a good point. I think he was kind of one of the pioneers of the ones invoking a shift. So, I think that's a good call on Thome because, the lefty slugger.
I wonder if it'll be tougher for left-handed hitter, power hitters like Thome, who come up in the league now, that's what they do. They hit home runs to right field because of the way that now defenses are being designed in baseball. I mean, there is a shift for every player.
It's an interesting thing to look at. He did hit a ton of balls the opposite direction. Yeah. Which were mostly home runs, but good.
The other thing too, as a White Sox fan, they had zero success with Jim.
Well, they went to the playoffs one year.
Yeah, okay, but he was traded.
Right?
He was traded for Aaron Rowan. Who's he traded for?
Yeah, Aaron Rowan. He was supposed to be that DH piece because remember Thomas had left, and then Everett and take over. His full body of work with the White Sox probably not his best
in
his career.
He hit his 500th homer,
but he had a ton of memorable moments. First game was a walk off. His 500th homer was a walk off. He had the home run in the blackout game against the Twins to propel them into the postseason. Yeah. So.
And he was, if I'm
he'll
not
go
mistaken,
in as an Indian for sure.
Yeah, he's
Indians.
Going in as a Cleveland Indian.
Oh,
so
that's too bad.
Forget him.
How long did he spend there? Yeah, really.
Like 11 or 12 years. So
who? Jim who?
Jim who?
No, congrats.
You could have him, Cleveland. We don't even want the guy.
No, sounds what a terribly nice guy. So
awesome,
congratulations to him. Well deserved. We're going to take a break here. On the other side, finish out the top five at five, give you your three, your two, and your one. You won't want to miss that. Con Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, Justin Kaufman sitting in for Ro, who's coming back tomorrow. I forgot you're a singer.
I am. Yes.
We'll save that for the end of the show, if there's time.
There won't be time.
Checking in at
number three.
WWE Chairman Vince McMahon, you hear this news, announcing he's bringing back a revamped XFL.
Oh, that's what was missing.
Yeah, we needed that. They did it for, a year, and then it's coming back. However, in contrast to the original league's focus on sports entertainment, theatrics, the new XFL will thrive on innovation, not controversy.
The new XFL will be fan-centric, with all the things you like to see and less of the things you don't. And no doubt, a lot of innovations along the way. We will present a shorter, faster-paced, family-friendly, and easier-to-understand game. Don't get me wrong, it's still football, but it's professional football reimagined.
I have no idea what this is going to be, but it's sort of like Trump saying we're going to build a wall, and then everyone in their head just you know,
has a different
thought of what this wall is going to be. So for the next 2 years, everyone's going to be like, the NFL sucks. It's so bad with the penalties and this and that. Now everyone's just going to imagine the XFL being this big, beautiful league, and it's probably going to be horrible.
Yeah, well, they're capitalizing on some political themes for sure. They're saying that everyone will be required to stand for the national anthem for XFL games.
You know what I was completely stunned by was when he said anybody with a criminal record will not be allowed in the league. And I'm like, really? I thought that's like kind of what they were going for.
That should be the new sport. They should just get rid of football. The XFL should just be standing for the national anthem. And the person
who stands the longest, who's the most patriotic?
Whoever's the most patriotic, who sings along perfectly and crisp, they win the game.
This dude stood for 2 days. It's a Hall of Famer in my book.
But even though he says that you gotta stand, this is interesting. Listen to this guy. It's another cut. He's also indicated the league will stay away from any on-field political statements.
As far as our league is concerned, it'll have nothing to do with politics. Absolutely nothing, and nothing to do with social issues either.
Oh, social issues too. So they're not going to wear the pink cleats
for breast cancer awareness,
huh, Vince?
And you know, everybody's so upset about the NFL implementing rules about, you know, protecting helmet to helmet hits, and I agree with some of the rules that have been put in place. I don't agree with some of them, but everyone thinks this is going to be like a mix of WWF and football. It was like body slams and head to head hits. Even though McMahon today stressed, he's like, "Nope, we're not going down that road. It's going to be very safe. We're going to take all the precautionary measures we need to take." So I'm like, what is this league going to be?
Here's what we got. A new league called the RFL, Robot Football League.
I like it.
Right? And robots play. And if they get hurt, like if they smash into each other and an arm falls off, they go on the side and it's engineers that are trying to solder it back on. And that's what's fun. Get number 42 back out there.
And like Jerry West is the logo for the NBA. The logo for the Robot League will be Cletus, the robot for Fox.
Or Wally from the Disney movie.
Yeah. Right. Wally like the water boy.
Wasn't the president an investor in the original
XFL? I think it was USFL, right?
USFL.
Yeah. Okay.
But still, I know Trump is going to love it.
He'll love this.
Well, because McMahon's wife is a part of
small business chief, Linda McMahon.
Right.
It's Trump's, in Trump's
life. I'll never forget telling my dad WWE's fake.
I didn't know either, but your dad.
Why'd you have to do that?
First of all, it's not fake, but that's okay.
Why'd you do that to him? All right, checking in at
number two.
We've heard from Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Boy, did he make news when he told a friend of the show, Brett Baer, about corruption and specifically mentioned the secret society off-campus visits with members of the DOJ and FBI. And he wasn't happy about it.
What this is all about is further evidence of corruption, more than bias, but corruption at the highest levels of the FBI and that secret society. We have an informant that's talking about a group that were holding secret meetings off-site. There's so much smoke here. There's so much suspicion.
Let's stop there. A secret society, secret meetings off-site of the Justice Department.
Correct.
And you have an informant saying that.
Yes.
Love that clip.
He's walked that back a bit because, he said an informant told him about it. Now the actual text has been revealed and many reporting that it's a real possibility it was written in jest.
Senator, this text message seems to be a comment about secret society was in jest. Do you agree that it appears to be it was in jest?
It's a real possibility.
So there you go.
That's what we said yesterday before it even started. I have enough trouble, Anna, with text from my wife reading the tone.
Trying to understand what
trying to understand.
Saying.
Was she mad? What's happening? I didn't know. This is a classic.
So there you go. Took a turn in 24 hours for sure.
And what's the hashtag now?
I don't know.
Right.
Hashtag we'll see.
This is sport. This is politics as we know it now.
It totally is.
Less than 24 hours. 24
hour news cycle. Your head goes one way to the other. Yeah. We're going to close this thing out with a guest we had earlier today. Such a powerful guest. Checking in at
number one.
So State Rep. Carol Senti announced a proposal today dubbed the Dave Duerson Act that would ban kids under the age of 12 from playing tackle football across the state of Illinois. That would be school programs, any program at all.
Youth programs,
it wouldn't be allowed. The bill is named after the late Super Bowl champ, of course, Chicago Bears defensive back, the late, great Dave Duerson, who took his own life in 2011. Duerson's son, Treg, was here with us earlier talking about why this legislation, it's so important.
We're emphasizing so much concussion protocol for the Cam Newtons of the world, but we're not talking about the millions of children below 12 that are playing football, who most of them will not attain the fortune of fame of pro football players.
Right.
And that's the most important piece of this. You know, the NFL has their own protocols and procedures to deal with, and to me, let's let them have their pro game, and they can do whatever they want with it. But for youth football, we as a society have to step in, and we can't look at them to be the leader.
I was just saying some of the getting constant hits and continual hits over time is what can also contribute to CTE, not just one or two big concussions, but the constant hitting. Treg also talked about why this cause is so important to them personally, the Duerson family.
Why I'm so passionate about it and why my family is so passionate about it is that when he did take his own life, he made the decision to donate his brain simultaneously. And that, to me, shows that this is someone who is looking out for other people and other interests in the future of, you know, football
that he loves.
And that to me is just, you know, I'm here today to keep honoring that legacy and his last wishes.
Incredible talking with him.
Yeah, that'll be up on WGNRadio.com, the full interview with him and Representative Senti. That was great stuff.
Yes, it was. We're going to save Judy's news in 2 minutes.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of a federal savings bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
A clip from the documentary Abacus. More on that in a moment. We've got Hawks Red Wings coming up at 6. But right now, be caller number 19, 312-981-7200 for your chance to rip us off for a $50 gift certificate to Lou Malnati's. Lou Malnati's is home to Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online, loumalnati's.com.
All right, 312-981-7200. It's the Ro Con Show with Anna DeVellantes. I'm Justin Kaufman in for Ro. He'll be back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. On the line with us from Park City, from Sundance, is Steve James. He's a filmmaker, one of the names that most people who enjoy film in Chicago know. He was the man behind The Interrupters, Life Itself, the Roger Ebert story, and of course, one of the best documentaries of all time, mm-hmm. Hoop Dreams. What do all of those films have in common? They were all snubbed by the Oscars. And Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel at the time during the Hoop Dreams, I think it was mid-90s, called it out as one of the worst snubs in Oscar history.
Right.
It was such a great film about two basketball players in high school and their lives during high school and after. The new film is Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, and that documentary featured the Chinese-owned bank in New York's Chinatown, Abacus Federal Savings Bank, being the only bank to actually go down during the subprime lending crisis in 2008. They were the only ones to actually be charged with criminal activity.
Right.
On the line with us from Park City at Sundance right now, Steve James. Steve, congratulations on an Oscar nomination for Abacus. Appreciate you joining us.
Congrats, Steve.
Yeah. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
How's Sundance treating you out there? Are you happy out there?
Yeah, it's snowing right now. I'm showing the first part of my big mini series that I did on Oak Park River Forest High School, so it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, and I want to get to that. So how's it feel to be finally nominated for an Oscar? As I mentioned in the lead, just the concept that you have been snubbed a couple of times in your career for outstanding work, including Hoop Dreams. How's it feel to finally get the Oscar nom?
Well, it feels great, and in a weird sort of way for me. I mean, I'm so happy for the Sung family that we profile in the film, that this will, you know, give a higher profile to their important story, a story that really wasn't told anywhere else, really, but in our film. And I'm also happy for, I don't know, in a way, I think about all the subjects, all the people that I've had the great fortune to follow and document their lives over the years. So in a way, it feels like it's for them, too.
How'd you come across this story of the Abacus Federal Savings Bank in Manhattan?
It was really producer Mark Mitten who caught my attention with it, because he knew the Sung family socially. And when this trial was about to kick off, he contacted me and he said, you know, there's this really crazy situation going on in New York City. This small community bank is being charged in the wake of the 2008 crisis. You know, they discovered the fraud themselves. They reported the fraud. They went out of their way to root out any fraud, and they were rewarded with being prosecuted by the DA of New York to say that they had orchestrated the fraud, which made no sense at all.
Yeah.
And so he told me about it. I went and shot in New York City for a few days and decided based on that that I was in, and let's make this film.
Given the critical acclaim you've achieved at this point, I imagine people come to you all the time with ideas. Everyone's got a documentary idea, and I'm sure at parties that's pretty fun for you. But I just wonder, what is it you look for when you're right, you're left? I can only imagine. But what do you look for here? Because I see some themes here in your work, but I'd love to hear you tell us what they are, what it is.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the films that I've done are about people who find themselves in some ways on the margins of society, you know, black and poor. In this case, the Sungs are not poor, but they're Chinese-American immigrant family and, you know, in a community that is not empowered at all in this country and certainly not in New York City. And they were, you know, victims of the unequal application of justice. So I find myself following stories of people who are at significant crossroads, too, in their lives, whether it's they're pursuing a basketball dream, trying to avoid prison, coming to America in search of a better life, or in this case, facing a trial that could be the end of their bank.
Steve, you're in Park City right now at Sundance. Of course, the news came out this week that your 10-part docuseries, America to Me, which has been talked about in circles here in Chicago for a couple years now, has been picked up by Stars at Sundance. It's the hit. It's a hit of the festival. How's it feel to be in the news? I mean, the idea of selling this and getting big headlines and for everyone from, you know, Hollywood Reporter to Variety talking about your work.
It's pretty heady, I have to say. It all kind of transpired over a course of about 3 days that we sold the film, and, you know, the sale became final. Then I got the Oscar nomination, Abacus, and then we had this great premiere of America to Me, the series, here. So, you know, I've had some pretty good days here. I don't know if I'll be able to top these anytime soon.
Do you wish you'd gotten the Oscar before the deal got closed, or that doesn't really matter to you? I mean, did that come to your mind?
Well, it's just the nomination, but they all
happen,
you know, really close to each other, and it was really pretty exciting. Still, is very exciting.
Oh, I bet.
This docuseries, The America to Me, it's, you know, it's going to be Stars and looking at the fall. But I mean, this is something you've been working on for a while. Talk about this, because this is, like I said, I mean, this is really the hit to come out of Sundance. Really about a story that takes place right here in our area at Oak Park River Forest High School.
Yeah, so I live there. I live in Oak Park, and my kids came through the school system there, including the high school. And for years, I thought it would be great to do a series, or do a film, really, but it became a series, on looking at race and achievement in a place like Oak Park, where you have, you know, it's a very liberal community. It's mostly affluent, although there's quite a range. It's got a public school system that's very well funded. Mm-hmm. And so if schools like Oak Park River Forest, like schools everywhere in the country, are falling short in terms of dealing with the disparities in achievement between whites and blacks, what's going on there? I just thought it would be really, you know, fascinating and revealing to go in there. Now, the school itself did not really want us to come in. The principal and the superintendent were opposed to it. But the school board itself took a courageous step. They were the ones that made the decision, and they said, we're going to allow this crew in for a school year and see what they come up with, because it might actually be helpful to our efforts to do something about these disparities.
And I imagine, I've been told the end result of it is not exactly what you could have expected going into it. And without revealing it, I imagine this starts a conversation about those kinds of issues of race.
Yeah, I mean, even a 10-hour miniseries isn't going to solve the, you know, quote-unquote so-called achievement gap. I mean, this is something that's bedeviled the educational system for decades. But I think what the film does do is it is a window into what it's like to be in a diverse school environment, particularly through the eyes of black and biracial kids and their families. And some of the struggles, some of the racism, implicit and explicit, that they face. Even today and even in liberal communities. And then you also see some incredibly dedicated teachers in this series that are working hard and inspiring. I mean, this series is not, you know, like an indictment of Oak Park River Forest High School at all. Mm-hmm. It's critical in ways, absolutely, but it also shows you know, people who are really working hard to do things right.
Yeah. Filmmaker Steve James, who both had a huge Sundance festival selling his docuseries to Stars about Oak Park River Forest High School. It's called America to Me. It'll be coming up this fall. Also getting an Oscar nomination for his film Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Steve, congratulations on all your success. Well-deserved, and Chicago's very proud. So, and appreciate you joining us. We appreciate it.
Say hi to Chaz Ebert for us, okay?
I will, and thank you for having me and for your support.
The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Justin Kaufman is here, and you know what I just did? I took Rose hand sanitizer and I hit it. Shh, don't tell him. He's coming back tomorrow. He's going to be like, where is me? Where is it?
That's an essential for Rokan.
I know. All of his cleaning equipment and that kind of thing. Yeah, he's going to be very upset without it.
Make the hand sanitizer, change it to glue. Something like that. Are we doing any pranks? No pranks?
That would be meaner.
You're more than welcome to, Justin.
Yeah, I don't have time.
Violetta knows better. I kind of do, too.
I don't have time, because after the Hawks game, I'm back on. I'm doing 10 to 11 tonight to download. Swap Meet, Greg Flamm will be here. This is one of my favorite segments.
I like that segment, too.
This is collectibles, memorabilia, the stuff that you've taken with you when you moved. And we will...
What survives the move?
312-981-7200. You call up, you tell us what you have, and Greg tells you if it's worth anything. And a lot of times,
it is.
No, that's... I'm the naysayer. I'm the one like, that ain't worth anything. He's like, actually, no, that's selling for $1,500. You're like, whoa.
Antique Roadshow.
Yeah, the Chicago Antique Roadshow.
What was their favorite one so far? Do you have, like, one that sticks out? Like,
there's always...
Wow.
In terms of a surprise, I mean. It's surprising to me that there will be things that I don't even think about that are like, Star Wars. It's always like toys.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, I've got this one toy. And I'm like, oh, who cares?
Who cares what toy you have? Does it truly have to be in the original packaging,
yeah,
as our parents
kind of
told
stuff.
Us?
There's a whole collector's
Hey, you know what I have still is an old XFL football from the original playing days.
I'll ask about
that. No way.
Yeah.
You do?
I was like, I need that football, Dad.
Yeah.
And the footballs were super cool. They were all black with the red stripes around them.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great one.
And I have an arena football one as well.
Ooh. See,
but they're
both not
in the box though, so maybe you can just let me know like what I can get eBay or Craigslist or something.
I have all the McDonald's Beanie Babies still in their original packaging.
What?
Oh wow,
Beanie Babies are
you
a big deal.
That?
Pay off your college student loans with them.
No,
really?
No, I know this. See, I'm retaining knowledge. Beanie Babies and cards and all that kind of stuff.
But these are the McDonald's ones.
And they're in the original packaging.
Yeah, but the issue is there's only that the myth is that all Beanie Babies are worth a lot of money. There's like three or four. It's almost like a collector's thing. He looks up. He's like, the McDonald's ones will probably get you
Beanie Babies
less.
Were the original Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Everyone went all in on the Beanie Babies.
And then how sad was it that I had a friend whose mom would not let her open them, the ones that were in package, or she'd just barely be able to take it out and put it back in because in the original packaging.
That's what Greg said. Greg said, buy two.
In the packaging, right. You're like, cool, look at this elephant.
I'm like throwing a football around with the packaging still on it.
This is what kids had to do because their parents
You know how many cheeseburgers I had to eat to get all of those? Now I'm addicted to McDonald's, and we wonder why.
That was true. I actually know a friend who has a franchise for McDonald's, and he says there were certain times when people would come through, buy a Happy Meal, and throw out the Happy Meal and just get the toy, to the point where they're like, you can't waste food. If you just want the toy, tell us, and we'll just give that to you.
Yeah, that's actually smart.
And on top of that, my sister almost just threw out my whole collection because she's like, I read an article that they're like making worms or something.
What?
Some sort of like bug that's coming out of the beanies inside the beanie. I didn't believe it either. It's still in my closet.
Sister's just jealous.
Yeah.
Don't touch my Beanie Babies.
Don't touch them, right.
At least not until we've talked to our friends here with Justin to see what they're worth.
Yeah, right.
What about three boxes worth of WWF wrestling figures? I also have a ring to go along with that. I got mini chairs to crack
That's
over
amazing.
That skull.
Yeah.
But they're all out. They're all out of the boxes.
Yeah.
I have the original Barbie's swimsuit.
Life. Okay.
Just the swimsuit. I don't know where the doll went because it was a hand-me-down and a hand-me-down. And
I learned that there's only specific Barbies because that became such a big thing in the 80s and on that it's not worth as much. It's specific. It's the same thing. Three or four of them that only get you money.
I have these creepy porcelain dolls someone from Texas gave me when I was little.
Okay, I'll check in on that
My
one.
My mom said they were worth something. She didn't let me play with them.
Creepy guy in Texas. That'll be the kicker, Justin. When he tells you it's worth nothing, be like, but it's from a creepy guy from Texas.
Texas creepy guy.
It's a lady. It's a lady
from Texas.
It's my mom's friend. I don't know.
I don't think it matters who gives it. It just matters what the... And it, sometimes it wouldn't have to be... Like, is it a certain type of porcelain that matters? Or
all that stuff matters. He's got all that stuff. I don't... I just give comic relief.
Yeah. Well, good.
We're asking Justin all the questions I've been asked 1,000 times already on this segment.
I know, segment. Right? It's not my thing. Anyway. All right, guys. Roe comes
good
back tomorrow.
Nice
working with you too, Justin. Blackhawks, Red Wings, coming up next, right here on WGN.